a day. I'm doing this on Tuesday, March the 8th, but it's scheduled to air March the 11th. So welcome, everybody. I hope you're having a good day. And we will have our change of light, our change of time in the day. It'll be advanced 1 hour on the 13th. But I believe what they call is the spring equinox, something like that. It'll happen March 21st. So we are springing around to the springtime. I heard something very interesting on the on my favorite TV show, BBC Earth, and Science TV will have a lot of space shows, so I'm subscribing to that. It's always good to watch those programs. You learn a lot. So what they were talking about, Mars has more of a wobble than Earth, and Earth is on a tilt of about 23 degrees. I think it was said that it varies somewhat, but not as much as Mars, where Mars has a definite wobble, where Earth is stabilized by the moon. Earth has one moon, Mars has two small moons that are both captured asteroids, and one will, in a few million years, spiral out into space, and the other one will crash land on Mars. So we were talking about, I was talking about this with another astronomer who was interested in it, and he's very interested in Mars. Not like me, I'm tepidly interested in Mars, because I think Mars has been on our plate for many years. It's been the most examined planet after Earth. There's been so many missions that I've talked about, and there's Perseverance. There's some new things which I will talk about today. But first, I'm going to talk about Mars' wobble. So Mars does not have a large enough moon to stabilize its, I don't want to say the wrong word. I don't want to say rotation or spin, just that it wobbles more than Earth. Earth's moon is relatively large compared to other moons in the solar system. So some astronomers have called it almost a two-planet system, the Earth and the Moon, because although the Moon is much smaller than the Earth, compared to other planets, it's relatively big. So the Moon has, it's slowly moving outwards, and it will eventually be so far out that it might affect our wobble in our planet Earth. So let's talk a little bit about Mars now. But first, before I forget, I also want to talk about what I saw on the TV show the other day, and it is about the sun. The sun apparently is entering a phase now. I'm not sure what to call it, a phase or a cycle. Again, I don't want to use the wrong word, but apparently for the next 23 to 25 years, there is a lack of sunspots, and this leads to, at least in history, astronomers have said, this leads to colder temperatures on Earth. So the Earth might be cooling down quite a bit for the next 23 to 25 years. And sometimes there's a certain cycle that is talked about for the sun, but I don't have all the exact facts on it, but astronomers have speculated that there could be other cycles. So apparently we're entering one now where, because of the lack of sunspots, the Earth will cool. So that might be a good thing for the Earth. And now let's talk about the Parker Solar Probe. So what is the Parker Solar Probe? It's a probe that is orbiting from, I believe, the Sun out to Venus and back. So it orbits the Sun. It's done 7th orbit so far. And it has studied the sun. And when I first talked about this Parker Solar Probe last year, I was surprised because I believe that there was almost everything that needed to be known about the sun was known. I thought there was a lot of knowledge that had been gained about the sun, but apparently there's a lot more. So this Parker Solar Probe is doing its 7th orbit. So I'll read an article about the Parker Solar Probe. It's dated March 5th, 2021, a couple days ago, and the title of it is Observations Around Solar System with Parker Solar Probe 7th Solar Encounter. And I asked an astronaut about this, sorry, an astronomer, I believe it was Trina Ray, because in a lot of these planetary encounters, and even with the sun, the probe or the spacecraft orbits in like an ellipse, and it goes far out, and then it comes back in, and it just keeps doing that. So I'm wondering, why isn't the probe closer to the planet? For example, Juno in Jupiter and Cassini in Saturn. And I was given, I think, a pretty good answer, but it was a little bit complicated, and I don't remember this exactly what was said about it. But anyway, Parker does that, I believe. It orbits out to Venus, or close to Venus, and then it comes back in towards the Sun. So now I'm going to talk about this article. Observations around solar system with Parker Solar Probe's seventh solar encounter. And this is dated March 5th, 2021. During Parker Solar Probe's seventh swing by the Sun, commonly in its closest solar approach, or perihelion, I think I've heard that word before, but sometimes you don't remember every word. On January 17th, 2021, celestial geometry posed a special opportunity. The configuration of this particular orbit placed Parker Solar Probe on the same side of the Sun as Earth, meaning that Earthbound observations could observe the Sun and its outpouring of solar wind from the same perspective as Parker's. This comes on the heels of a similar observation campaign in the winter of 2020. So says Noor Raoufi, the Parker Solar Probe project scientist from Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland, and quote, along with the global science community, the Parker Solar Probe team can't wait to see this new data. Combining it with contributions from observations around the globe will help us to put Parker observations in a broader context and build a complete picture of the phenomena observed in the solar atmosphere, end quote. So again, I don't have to say this. I've probably said it before, but I'm going to say it again. This person, Noor Raoufi, the Parker Solar Probe project scientist, I really envy people like this because this is my hobby, studying astronomy, just learning about astronomy, and it's their job. So that's amazing that they can have these jobs on my favorite topic in the universe. So my favorite topic is the universe. Continue with the article. Read on for snapshots from a few missions that observed the Sun and the solar system during Parker Solar Probe's seventh solar encounter. One thing that I do marvel at sometimes, I was thinking about this yesterday, and I'll talk about this to do with the Earth and the Sun. So here we are, we're standing on a rock, moving at a certain speed through space, and we're orbiting a star, which is a huge thing, and it's not the biggest star in the universe by far, and it somehow can stay together. Given that 600 million tons of hydrogen are converted into helium in its core every second. Just amazing how these big things happen. And then our Sun is orbiting the center of our solar system at about, I guess it's called a galactic year. Galactic year is about 230 to 240 million years. That's how long it takes for the Sun to orbit around the center of our galaxy, which is about 25 or 26,000 light years away. And there's a dark hole in there, Sagittarius A star. So all this stuff just still tickles me pink. I'm crazy about it. So anyway, I just had to get that out because it is quite amazing. So now, on this article, which is called Observations Around Solar System with Parker Solar Probe 7 Solar Encounter, that's on livescience.com, March 5th. There's quite a few pictures here. It says JAXA, which is something to do with the Japanese Aeronautics Agency, and NASA Hinode observes the Sun on January 17, 2021. It's a video. And there's another one, the Sun seen by NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory, January 12 to 23, 2021. And another picture is NASA's Interface Region Imaging spectrograph sees the sun on January 17th, 2021. And here's a nice little graph that's moving. It shows the Global Oscillation Network Group has done some kind of graph. It doesn't say what the coordinates are. It just says CR2240 and the other axis going up. I don't know what it is. It's some kind of position. But anyway, just amazing stuff. These images were captured by the X-ray telescope, or XRT, aboard the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency's, there it goes, JAXA, Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency's, and NASA's Hinode spacecraft. XRT watches the sun in X-rays, a high-energy type of light that reveals the extremely hot material in the sun's atmosphere, the corona. So again, something I heard a few weeks ago that still really fascinates me is if we had X-ray visions, there'd be 24 hours of sunlight. So X-rays are all around us every second, and because we only see visible light, we see when the sun sets, there's no more, it gets dark. And so if we had X-ray vision like Superman, it would be light in the nighttime as well. These images from XRT were captured on January 17th when Parker Solar Probe was closest to the sun. Scientists can use XRT's images with Parker Solar Probe's direct measurements of the environment around the sun to better understand how the sun's corona could drive changes in the space environment farther away from the sun. And here's another one. From the Solar Dynamics Observatory, the sun seen by NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory. Oh yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about. This just popped into my mind, and if I don't mention it now, then I'll probably forget mention it. But I do remember that when the British collected their countries in Asia and made an empire, at the beginning, hundreds of years ago, there was no cables laid in the sea. So the only way someone could communicate would be to send a message, let's say from India. They'd have to sail from India to Britain, which would take 6 months. And then when the people in Britain got the message, they'd respond and send it back by boat. And there was another 6 month delay. So it'd be about a year for messages to get back and forth. Then the Suez Canal opened, then they laid cable on the seas, and then now they have satellites. So the progression in terms of technology has been amazing, and that's what we have to do in terms of our solar system. Now it's possible that if we travel to Mars, it'll take us 6 months to get there. And just like the messages from India, it took 6 months to travel to England, and it would take 6 months to travel back. So the return message from England would take 6 months. Now it's done in a blink of an eye. So are we going to see in the future improvements in technology in terms of in flying in space? We'll see, hopefully. But you can imagine in a couple hundred years from now, things will be totally different. So NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory keeps a constant eye on the sun from its vantage point in orbit around Earth. SDO captures images of the sun in extreme ultraviolet light, a type of light that is invisible to our eyes, and visible light, as well as magnetic maps of the sun. SDO's data can help scientists understand the connection between conditions on the sun and what is measured in the solar wind by spacecraft like Parker Solar Probe. These images were captured in 211 angstrom, a wavelength of extreme ultraviolet light emitted by material around 3 million degrees Fahrenheit. So I believe 1 angstrom, is it 10 to the 8, minus 8, or 10 to the minus 6 meters? I'm not sure. Because very many times they say, oh, this visible light is 4,000 angstrom. So I'm trying to think. I'm not sure exactly what an angstrom is in terms of a meter. I'll look it up. I'm not going to look it up in the show, but I'll look it up and tell you next time. The wavelength highlights both active regions, seen as bright spots in the image, and coronal holes, areas of open magnetic fields in the sun from which high seed solar wind can rush out into space. Coronal holes appear as dark areas in the wavelength of light. So I did taped that show on my, what do you call it, DVR about the sun. I'll have to look through it because the only thing that I did remember, I was changing channels, and it was talking about the thing I just talked about, the sun, in terms of its the sunspots waning, and that could mean a new cycle of 23 to 25 years where the Earth will considerably cool down. So that's happened before in history. Now there's another subtitle. It says IRIS. So NASA's Interface Region Imaging Spectrograph sees the sun on January 17, 2021. So I believe there's been something like 15 probes of spacecraft or rovers on Mars combined just from NASA. There's quite a few imaging the sun. There's some like Hubble and other ones like the Fermi X-ray telescope looking around our universe to see wonderful things. And I'll talk about that a bit later, about a new quasar that was just found that's apparently 13 billion years. So it took 13 billion years for the light to travel. So what I'm saying, what I'm getting at, is there's an amazing amount of science going on in space. When the Perseverance rover landed on Mars, it captures people's attention, and I could see people were very excited. The news, the talk shows would talk about it, but there's just an immense amount going on in space in terms of NASA and other space agencies. So again, if you want to see some beautiful pictures of the sun or movies, this article is called Observations Around Solar System with Parker Solar Probe's Seventh Solar Encounter. It's on LiveScience.com, and it's March 5th, 2021. NASA's Interface Region Imaging Spectrograph, or IRIS, captures images of the lower regions of the sun's atmosphere in ultraviolet light, along with spectra that break down how much light is visible across different wavelengths. These images, captured on January 17th, show an active region on the sun, an area of intense and complex magnetic fields that is prone to explosions of light and solar material. This particular active region was targeted for IRIS observations based on model predictions that suggested that magnetic field lines from this region could be ones Parker Solar Probe would cross and measure during its solar encounter. The images cycle through different wavelengths of light, corresponding to views of different heights above the solar surface, to reveal features in various regions of the sun's structure. This imagery shows features from the solar surface to a few thousand miles above, at the top of the chromosphere, a region of the sun's atmosphere that interfaces with the extended solar atmosphere beyond. And one of the most interesting things, I did a show a few years ago about the, I guess it's called, on Earth we'd call it, I believe it's called seismography, or where scientists send a sound wave down into the Earth, and then when it bounces back up, the time it takes for it to bounce up and things like that, they can paint a pretty good picture of what is happening inside the Earth, what its layers are, things like that. So the same thing happens in the sun, where there could be, I think, 700 musical tones made by the sun itself. So the sun itself produces these tones, and that depends on the sound waves that are bouncing from the surface of the sun down below. So scientists somehow, which is just a totally complicated thing, I don't think I could even begin to understand it, that they can tell about certain things of the sun's interior by these sound waves, which is really phenomenal. And so going on, there's something called GONG. So the National Science Foundation's Global Oscillation Network Group, GONG, so that's Global Oscillation Network Group, again, G-O-N-G, GONG, is a network of solar imagers distributed around the globe. They make use of the Zeeman effect. I studied that before, and I can't remember, I think light splitting, let's see. How light splits into multiple wavelengths under the influence of a magnetic field to create magnetic maps on the solar surface. This video shows Gong's magnetic maps, updated hourly from January 12 to 23, 2021. The black areas represent areas where the magnetic field is pointing in towards the sun's surface, and white areas are where the magnetic field is pointing out into space. So this, this is kind of a complicated map. On its axes, it doesn't really show any coordinates or anything, or what units there are, so I can't figure it out. So again, go to this article if you want to look at that. As the solar wind streams out from the sun, it carries a solar magnetic field with it, but identifying precisely which regions on the sun are the source for solar wind measured by spacecraft like Parker Solar Probe is a challenging task for several reasons. The sun rotates, solar wind leaves the sun at varying speeds, and strong magnetic fields near the sun can change the solar wind's path as it flows out. The Parker Solar Probe team uses Gong's magnetic maps along with data from NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory to make predictions of which regions on the sun are sending out material and magnetic field lines toward the spacecraft. Drawing these connections between the sun itself and the solar wind that Parker Solar Probe is measuring directly can help scientists trace how conditions on the sun propagate out into space. So I remember reading about speculation how an advanced society, advanced alien race, could somehow be siphoning energy off its star. Will we ever get to that? We'll see. Could be hundreds or thousands of years from now. Now here's another subtitle called Themis. So Themis spacecraft, short for Time History of Events and Macroscale Interactions During Substorms. So Themis, T-H-E-M-I-S. A trio of NASA's Themis spacecraft, short for Time History of Events and Macroscale Interactions During Substorms, orbit Earth to measure particles and electric and magnetic fields in near-Earth space. Themis's data helps researchers untangle the complicated factors that govern the response of near-Earth space to dynamics in Earth's magnetic field, changes in the sun's constantly outflowing solar wind, and activity of the sun. These measurements were taken by Themis E, one of the spacecraft in orbit around Earth, on January 20. It takes about 2 or 3 days for solar wind to cross the tens of millions of miles from the sun to Earth, so the solar wind conditions observed by Parker Solar Probe during its close solar approach on January 17th did not begin to influence near-Earth space until about January 19 to 20, so it takes 3 days. So I believe the solar wind travels about 1 million miles an hour, which is much slower than the speed of light. So here again, there's some very complicated graphs. And if you have a PhD in physics and astronomy, you can read this graph. Again, the article is called Observations Around Solar System with Parker Solar Probe's Seventh Solar Encounter, dated March 5th, 2021, on livescience.com. What I really like about this article so far is they're giving certain information, then there's about 5 videos, and there's some of the science, and there's some graphs. So it's quite in-depth, which some articles are not so in-depth. They talk about a big proposition, or I'm not sure what it's called, I don't want to say the wrong word. But they say, okay, this is what we think this theory is about. And then there's no explanation to follow. So here it's got a lot of meat if someone is interested in solar dynamics, and it looks very interesting. Themis began in the day traveling through the Van Allen radiation belt, concentric bands of charged particles nested in Earth's magnetic field as it approached Earth. Themis E then traveled back outward through the radiation belts. Both transits through the radiation belts are reflected in the areas of intense coloring in the lower part of the plot at the beginning of the day. So let's see if I can notice that. Okay, on some of the plots, yeah, I can see that, where there's red and yellow, pretty intense. So that would be for the beginning of the day. Mid-morning, Themis E left Earth's magnetic field and entered the magnetosheath, the region just outside the outermost sun-safe sun-facing boundary of Earth's magnetic field, where solar wind piles up as it collides with Earth's magnetic field. So the magnetosphere is a very complex thing. It looks like a teardrop. It's very complicated, and of course, it's very interesting to look at the different layers and how it does protect the Earth. So not all, I believe, you have to have a core, iron core in your planet to have a magnetosphere or magnetosphere. Throughout the day, gusts in the solar wind temporarily push the boundaries of the magnetosphere earthward, meaning that Themis repeatedly left and re-entered the magnetosheath. So I guess a spacecraft can do that. I don't think humans can keep on doing that for about 15 hours until its orbit carried it back into the magnetosphere later in the day. Themis E alternately observed the unperturbed solar wind outside the magnetosheath and piled up solar wind in the magnetosheath. The undistributed solar wind observed by Themis E was a bit slower than usual, but also about twice as dense as typical solar wind. Observations also confirmed by NASA's Advanced Composition Explorer and Wind spacecraft, which orbit further upstream between the Sun and Earth. So again, this article's finished. It's just a really good article. It's by Sarah Frazier, NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, Greenbelt, Maryland. And if you're interested in the Sun, you can look at it, because especially the experts, they might find this interesting, but to them this is like just a yawner, just typical day, run-of-the-mill, day-to-day stuff. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. But anyway, and I do recall Goddard, the person who, Rocket Godfather. Okay, so I've talked about the Sun now. When I come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about a quasar that's 13 billion light years away. No small distance. And then I'm also going to talk something about Mars. So thank you for listening. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Discorder magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. I talked for about 27 minutes there, which is a bit long. I should have taken a break before, but this was generally a good article that I just read. And as I said, some articles leave you wanting because they don't give much explanation. They don't offer any explanations. They just basically posit something. They say, oh, we think this is happening or this might happen. But then they don't give you any solid stuff to look at, but the previous article did. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about NASA's Perseverance drives on Mars terrain for the first time. And I think what they have also is there is a helicopter for the first time. And I don't know if it is Titan, but I do believe there's the Clipper mission for NASA, which is one of the, it could be Ganymede, one of the large moons of Jupiter. And scientists are thinking about getting a submarine down into the waters of one of these moons. So that would be great. So now we have we've had rovers. Now we have a little helicopter. And one day soon we might get a submarine to go to the outer reaches of space in one of the moons. And let's keep going. This is now Mars. So Mars has a time slot here. This is dated March 5th, 2021. The article is on livescience.com. And the title is NASA's Perseverance Drives a Mars Terrain for the First Time. And it shows a picture here of the terrain. And I love those, one of the wheels. I'm not sure if it's like a tractor kind of mechanism where you have a long belt going around or just different wheels. But NASA's built all its known, all its know-how, it discovered from previous Mars mission into this rover. So hopefully, like some rovers, it won't break down. And I remember one rover was possibly lost to a dust storm because the dust blew over the rover. And because of that, the rover could not receive any sunlight. So it couldn't power up its system. So I believe it was lost. So here is this image was captured with while NASA's Perseverance rover drove on Mars for the first time on March 14, 2021. One of Perseverance hazard avoidance cameras, it is called MAC cams, I believe, captured this image in the rover as the rover completed a short traverse and turned from its landing site in Jezero Crater. One thing that was, I never would have thought of this, but one of the other rovers, I was reading the story and it wasn't online. It was just something that, to pass my time, you know, because I'm an astronomer, I like astronomy. And I thought it was very interesting that we see these pictures of the rover and, oh, that looks nice, that looks beautiful. But actually, the rover that I was reading about a couple of years ago, it was driving like a couple of miles an hour, maybe even less than that. It just took a long time to get around. So they're not high-speed vehicles. I don't know what the top speed of Perseverance was, but sometimes these rovers could get stuck in the rocks or in traps there on Mars. So I believe what they had, and they probably have this in Perseverance, they probably have a model of Perseverance right here on Earth. So it is maybe trying to mimic the movement of Perseverance. And let's say in case something goes wrong, then they could try to fix it with their model down here on Earth. So I thought that was really cool how they would do that. They'd have the duplicate model here on Earth and people would play around with that. And very fascinating stuff, really cool. Anyway, NASA's Mars 2020 Perseverance rover performed its first drive on Mars, March 4th, covering 21.36 feet, 6.5 meters across the Martian landscape. So that's just what I was talking about. It only went 21 feet, 26.5 meters. So for example, if you have in football, first down, first and 10, if you get 10 yards, then you got 30 feet, that's a first down. And this is 21.3 feet. So as I thought, but I thought it would drive faster, but anyway, it doesn't drive very fast. It takes a long time. So if there's exploration that needs to be done, there's really a lot of time, I believe, spent on going to different areas. So it's not such a straightforward thing. A lot of patience involved and 21.3 feet in a day. Wow, that's not very far. So the drive served as a mobility test that marks just one of many milestones as team members check out and calibrate every system, subsystem, and instrument on Perseverance. Once the rover begins pursuing its science goals, regular commutes extending 200 meters or more are expected. Oh, that's very good. So what I believe that to be would be 200 meters in one day. So that's two Canadian football fields or just a bit longer. So that's, I believe it is a real improvement because before I do remember that the previous rovers would take so long to get around Mars. And of course, if they got stuck or they'd have to try to get them out of traps or climb over rocks. And so this is really a lot of careful, meticulous science that, as I said, requires a lot of patience from the scientist. So says Anais Zarafian, a Mars 2020 Perseverance rover mobility testbed engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Quote, when it comes to wheeled vehicles on other planets, there are few first-time events that measure up in significance to that of the first drive. This was our first chance to kick the tires and take Perseverance out for a spin. The rover's six-wheel drive responded superbly. We are now confident our drive system is good to go, capable of taking us wherever the science leads us over the next 2 years. End quote. So again, this is something that for the people who have just gotten interested in Mars lately, and I know over the years there's been some pictures from Mars and stuff, but I don't know how, because I myself, this is my hobby, astronomy, but I don't read about Mars very much. But maybe people like the general public, they didn't know that there's all these things that that all these difficulties that have to be overcome when they're driving on Mars. So the drive was lasted about 33 minutes. So that's 33 minutes, and they went 6.5 feet. So let's just double that. Let's say they went 14 feet in 1 hour. So how many miles is that? A very, very small spec, 0.000 something miles an hour. So you can see how slow the vehicle went. So the drive, which lasted about 33 minutes, propelled the rover forward 13 feet or 4 meters, where it turned in place 150 degrees to the left and backed up 8 feet, 2.5 meters, into its new temporary parking space. To help better understand the dynamics of a retro rocket landing on the red planet, engineers used Perseverance's navigation and hazard avoidance cameras to image the spot where Perseverance touched down, dispersing Martian dust with plumes from its engine. Now here's another subtitle, More Than Roving. The rover's mobility system is not the only thing getting a test drive during the period of initial checkouts. On February 26, Perseverance's 8th Martian day, or sol, since landing, so a sol is, I think it's 26 hours of an Earth day, mission controllers completed a software update, replacing the computer program that helped land Perseverance with one they will rely on to investigate the planet. More recently, the controllers checked out Perseverance radar imager for Mars subsurface experiment, or RIMFAX, and Mars's oxygen in-situ resource utilization experiment, MOXIE, instruments, and deployed the Mars Environmental Dynamics Analyzer, MEDA, META, instruments to wind sensors, which extend out from the rover's mast. Another significant milestone occurred on March 2nd or Sol 12, when engineers unstowed the rover's 7-foot-long, 2-meter robotic arm for the first time. Wow, 2-meter-long robotic arm. That's so cool. Flexing each of its 5 joints over the course of just 2 hours. So I can just imagine in the future, if people do go to Mars, whenever that happens, we're going to have a little, like an R2-D2 or what's it called, C-3PO, extending its long arm, being just a basic machine, but it's going to be our helper and it's going to communicate with us. So looking forward to that if that happens anytime soon. So says Robert Hogg, a Mars 2020 Perseverance rover deputy mission manager, and quote, Tuesday's first test of the robotic arm was a big moment for us. That's the main tool the science team will use to do close-up examination of the geologic features of Jezero Crater, and then we'll drill and sample the cores they find the most interesting. When we get confirmation of the robotic arm flexing its muscles, including images of it working beautifully after its long trip to Mars, well, it made my day, end quote. I bet it did. Just such fascinating stuff. Upcoming events and evaluations include more detailed testing and calibration of science instruments, sending the rover on long drives, and jettisoning covers that shield both the adaptive catching assembly part of the rover's sample catching system and the Ingenuity Mars helicopter during landing. The experimental flight test program for the Ingenuity Mars helicopter will also take place during the rover's commissioning. It's not going. I was going to take a break, but I'll just finish this article. Through it all, the rover is sending down images from the most advanced suite of cameras ever to travel to Mars. Yes, you can see the quality of these pictures. Just wonderful. The mission's cameras have already sent out about 7,000 images. On Earth, Perseverance imagery flows through the powerful deep space network managed by NASA Space Communications and Navigation, SCAN program. In space, several Mars orbiters play an equally important role. So says Justin Mackey, chief engineer for imaging and the imaging scientist for the rover. And quote, orbiter support for downlink of data has been a real game changer. When you see a beautiful image from Jezero, consider that it took a whole team of Martians to get it to you. Every picture from Perseverance is relayed by either the European Space Agency's Trace Gas Orbiter or NASA's MAVEN, which is Mars, or Mars Odyssey, or Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. They are important partners in our explorations and our discoveries, end quote. So you can see how all the rovers and satellites and stuff around Mars are working together for this, which is just amazing. The sheer volume of imagery and data already coming down on the mission has become a welcome bounty for Matt Wallace, who recalls waiting anxiously for the first images to trickle down during NASA's first Mars rover mission, Sojourner, which explored Mars in 1997. On March 3rd, Wallace became the mission's new project manager. He replaced John McNamee, who is stepping down as he intended after helming the project for nearly a decade. Quote from Wallace, John has provided unwavering support to me and every member of the project for over a decade. He has left his mark on this mission and team, and it has been my privilege to not only call him boss, but also my friend, end quote. So I do recall when I talked to Trina Ray, she had been on the Cassini mission, maybe 20, 25 years, and before that she was on my favorite mission, which is the Voyager spacecraft. So these scientists dedicate a lot of their life. Guess what? I thought this article was ending, so I'll just quickly brush over a few things that's still going on. So again, this is a very good article if you want to read it. NASA's Perseverance drives on Mars terrain for the first time. March 5th, 2021 on livescience.com. It says release 21-027. And so a subtitle is Touchdown Site Name. With Perseverance Department departing from its touchdown site, mission team scientists have memorialized the spot and formally named it for the late science fiction author Octavia E. Butler. The groundbreaking author and Pasadena, California native was the first African-American woman to win both the Hugo Award and Nebula Award, and she was the first science fiction writer honored with a MacArthur Fellowship. This location where Perseverance began its mission on Mars has now bears the name Octavia E. Butler Landing. Butler, who died in 2006, authored such novels as work as Kindred, Bloodhood, Speech Sounds, Parable of the Sower, Parable of the Talents, and the Paternist series. Her writing explores the theme of race, gender equality, and humanity, and her works are as relevant today as they were when originally published. Now, this the last section is more about the mission. A key objective of Perseverance mission on Mars is astrobiology, including the search for signs of ancient microbial life. The rover will characterize the planet's geology and past climate, pave the way for human exploration of the red planet, and be the first mission to collect and cache Martian rock and regolith. Subsequent NASA missions, in cooperation with ESA, would send spacecraft to Mars to collect these sealed samples from the surface and return them for Earth for in-depth analysis. The Mars 2020 Perseverance mission is part of NASA's Moon to Mars exploration approach, which includes Artemis missions to the Moon that will help prepare for human exploration of the red planet. JPL, which is managed for NASA by Caltech and Pasadena, built and manages operations of the Perseverance rover. So for more about Perseverance, go to www.nasa.gov/Perseverance or https://mars.nasa.gov/mars2020. And for information about NASA's Mars missions, go to https://www.nasa.gov/mars. And for images, go to https://go.nasa.gov/perseverance-raw-images. So again, to see this all, it is on the NASA's Perseverance Drives on Mars Terrain for the First Time article on livescience.com, dated March 5th, 2021. And this, I recommend this article because it's got so many nuggets of information, just like the previous article I read about the sun. So I'm batting 2 for 2. I think I picked some pretty good articles. Okay, so I'm going to go for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a bit about cosmology and things that are very far away from us. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
Red Camp Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of 2 or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
CITR 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine are celebrating Asian heritage by telling notable stories of Asian Canadians.
Ujjal Dosang was born in Jalandhar, India in 1947 and moved to Vancouver at the age of 17. He learned English by editing a Punjabi newspaper, eventually earning a law degree at UBC. After practicing family and personal injury law in private practice, he was elected as MLA to Vancouver Kensington in 1991. From there, he became Attorney General in 1997 and Canada's first South Asian Premier in February of 2000.
For more information about how to celebrate Asian heritage in Vancouver, visit exploration.org.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. There was a program that is on right now, I believe right now. It's on Science Channel 109, and it's about talking about dwarf planets. And I don't got 109, so I tried to phone in, and they were closed, so I will get that station tomorrow, and hopefully I can talk about dwarf planets. Anyway, now I'm going to go on a bit of a tangent. I'm going to go away from the sun and the solar system and talk about quasars. So, universe's oldest known quasar discovered 13 billion light years away. So this is on livescience.com, dated Tuesday, March the 9th. And just a comment about the topics I talked about the past few week in an introduction about how astronomers can pretty well pin down what happened after or during the first 3 minutes after the Big Bang. So one thing when I was reading their articles and then listening to them speak, what was so amazing was how they back everything up with science. But the other thing is amazing is how a scientist can say, okay, one billionth, trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, this is what happened. Then 1 billionth after a second after the Big Bang, this is what happened. Then 1 millionth of a second after the Big Bang, this is what happened. And 1 hundredth of a second and 0.1 and then 1 second. Scientists can say that this is exactly what happened. And when I listen to them, it sounds very convincing. I don't have any background or challenge with their saying, but it's just amazing how could they know to that precision. Anyway, that's talking about what happened in the early part of the universe, and now we're going to talk about the universe's oldest known quasar discovered 13 billion light years away by Tim Childers on livescience.com 12 hours ago, which means it was done on Tuesday, March 9th. And the subtitle is, astronomers have found the farthest known source of radio emissions in the universe, a galaxy-swallowing supermassive black hole. So again, the article is called Universe's Oldest Known Quasar Discovered 13 Billion Light Years Away. So there's an artist's depiction of the most distant single source of radio emission in the universe, a quasar known as P172 plus 18. So there's a logic behind the naming and the numbering of these, and I think I looked at that one time. But there's, like, for example, neutron stars, and for quasars, and then magnetars, and all these different things. A star system, a galaxy, they have all these cool naming systems. So anyway, I'm going to start reading the article. Astronomers have discovered the most distant and ancient single source of radio emissions in the known universe. That source is one of the universe's most powerful particle accelerators, a quasar 13 billion light years away from Earth, spewing jets of particles at nearly the speed of light. Quasars are some of the oldest, most distant, most massive, and brightest objects in the universe. They make up the cores of galaxies, where a rapidly spinning supermassive black hole gorges on all the matter that's unable to escape its gravitational grasp. While the black hole is devouring this matter, it's also blasting out an enormous amount of radiation that collectively can be more than a trillion times more luminous than the brightest stars, making quasars the brightest objects in the observable universe. So again, when I listened to Dr. Kip Thorne, he was at UBC, and he talked about the neutron star merger that LIGO measured, and he was involved in that project, and he was involved in setting all the specs, I believe, when they were building this monster LIGO. So I think what he said is there was two black holes that merged, and one of them was something like 29, the mass of 29 stars, suns. The other one was something like the mass of 35 or 30-something suns. So when they merged, and it chewed up 5 solar masses of energy. So I believe at that time he said, I can't remember exactly what he said because I didn't write it down, but I thought it was the most luminous event ever in the universe that was recorded by us, the human race. So now this says that quasars are the brightest objects in the observable universe. So when Dr. Kip Thorne says something, I got to know exactly what he said. So I'll try to look that up as well. Okay, here's another article. It says, related, the 12 strangest objects in the universe. So in this, there's a video here. It says, astrophysicist Paul Sutter explains how the universe began. So if you're interested in that, again, go to livescience.com. Universe's oldest known quasar discovered 13 billion light years away. And I know that I will be looking at this thing later on, because that kind of stuff really interested me. So says Eduardo Benedos. Who led the discovery along with somebody called Chiara Mazzucchelli, and quote, given that these objects are so luminous, they can be observed very far away. When galaxies like the Milky Way are too faint to be detected and studied at these distances, we can use these very luminous quasars to study when the universe was very young. We're talking about a time when the first stars and galaxies formed. End quote. So again, that's before the dinosaurs, way before. This quasar in particular, named P172+18, is a relic from about 780 million years after the Big Bang and reveals clues about one of the earliest ages of the universe, the epoch of reionization. So I read that before, the epoch of reionization. Is that when something with electrons making something happen? Anyway. I guess it cool. Okay, at the start of this period, the universe was darkly veiled by a mostly uniform cloud of hydrogen gas. Scientists refer to this time as universe's dark ages. Pretty cool name, because most light emitted was quickly absorbed by the neutrally charged gas. Eventually, gravity collapsed the primordial gas into the first stars and quasars, which began to heat and ionize the surrounding gases, allowing light to pass through. Mazzucchelli, an astronomer at the European Southern Observatory in Chile, and Benedos, an astronomer at the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Germany, first spotted the quasar while using the Magellan telescope at Las Campas Observatory in Chile. They observed the telltale radio signature left by powerful jets of particles erupting from above and below the black hole. Okay, let's read that again. They observed the telltale radio signature left by powerful jets of particles erupting from above and below the black hole. So this thing is so far away, but they can still tell where it's coming from, pinpoint it from to this quasar. Pretty cool. The super speedy particles emit a tremendous amount of radio waves. Scientists call these quasars radio loud and believe they're jets of accelerated particles, which are seen only in about 10% of quasars, play a pivotal role in the evolution of early galaxies. Further observations from telescopes, including the Keck Observatory in Hawaii and the Very Large Telescope in Chile, showed that P172 plus 18 is nearly 300 million times more massive than the Sun. 300 million times, wow. And is among the fastest growing quasars ever discovered. The problem is scientists don't know how a black hole became so massive this early on in the universe. The radio jets could be an explanation. So they say further observations from telescopes, including the Keck Observatory. If you're ever going to go to Hawaii, well, you go up to the peak at the top, and the Keck Observatory actually has tours. So going back and forth to this Keck Observatory is not easy, because just like me, myself, I would have to rent a car, which is, they don't have any deals there. It's very expensive. It's like $80 to $200 a day. And I hitched a ride with a Japanese guy named Masa. We went up and we just missed the closing time. So if you ever go up there, try to look ahead where you can get on one of the tours, because it would be fascinating. So says Mazzucchelli, and quote, theoretical studies say that the presence of radio jets can increase the speed of which the black hole eats matter, which means they can allow for a black hole to grow much faster and might explain why the black holes are so massive so early. At the same time, radio jets may also impact the galaxy surrounding the quasar by influencing how stars form. Okay, I'll buy that. However, the black hole's feeding frenzy may not have lasted long. When the astronomers compared their most recent observations to a survey of the sky taken more than two decades before, they discovered that the quasar had lost half its brightness, signaling that the quasar was possibly reaching the last stages of its life. Beacons in the dark. Mazzucchelli described quasars as distant flashlights that illuminate a specific time and space in the universe's history. Each new quasar discovered reveals another patch in the timeline between the Big Bang and the universe we see today. She's hopeful that the research team will find many more nearby quasars in the future. In fact, not long after the discovery of P172 plus 18, the astronomers found a second beacon of radio waves nearby. If further observations confirm that this companion radio source lies at the same distance as the quasar, it could be the most distant pair of active galaxies ever discovered. The researchers hope telescopes such as NASA's James Webb Telescope will be able to determine the radio source's exact distance. The researchers' finding will be published in a forthcoming issue of the Astrophysical Journal. So I really liked the articles I talked about today, because they were about cool stuff, and there was a lot of information, a lot of diagrams, and a lot of referencing to things where sometimes just some kind of complicated theory is brought out, and then it left you wondering, well, I really don't understand this. So these articles went the distance. They did very well. So thank you for listening. This has been Marco. You have been listening to Astrotalk on CITR 101.9.